Hello and welcome to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I am your host, Wade. I'm joined with Ben.
Hello.
And a special guest, Kellen Berg. How's it going, man?
Hey, it's going good.
You're a fellow filmmaker here in the Twin Cities. You're part of a group called Woolly Rhino, based here, that makes some pretty awesome stuff. What kind of work do you guys do?
Well, basically, it's the company. We produce videos for nonprofits and tech startups and any other various companies that need videos for their websites or internally or like a sales video. So that's basically the main thing we do during the day. And then on the side, we obviously do our creative side projects.
Businessmen by night.
No, by day.
By day and scoundrels by night.
No, businessmen 24/7.
Yeah.
scoundrels by night.
Right. So this episode is going to be all about writing, specifically screenwriting, and the tools and methods that we use to help us out. So as far as software goes, there's a few different pieces of software you can download to help with writing. The one that Callan and I used when we were in film school was called Movie Magic. I think it cost us like $100 at the time.
$100.
Yeah, and which was discounted.
Yeah, it's discounted. I think now, I think there might be a sale right now. That it's for $100.
Yeah, and I don't think that they really update it too much anymore.
No.
Because like I have a Retina Mac and it's still like it doesn't look crisp on a Retina display, implying that they haven't updated it to look good on that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the reason why we're talking about software is because it's really important when you're writing a screenplay, whether it's a short or, you know, a feature or a commercial or whatever, to put it in a proper screenplay format. One of the first things we learned on our first day of screenwriting was like, format's very important. And what did our professor say? He said, every single day, or the day that you decided to become a screenwriter, like 50 scripts arrived on the desk of some intern at like WB or something like that they had to sift through. So there's just like a really saturated market for these sorts of things. And so you have to work hard to get up to the level you're supposed to be and try to set yourself above it. So format is really important. You can't just open up Microsoft Word and expect to pen a script and have it be in the proper format. What are the kind of things that Movie Magic or the other softwares do to help it out?
For like Movie Magic and Final Draft, they're very good with formatting. And for me, I can usually write quicker. And then on the topic of a person receiving scripts, like no one's going to take you seriously if you write it in Microsoft Word. Like it'll show up on your desk and you'll just look at it and be like, garbage, and throw it in the garbage.
Or recycling.
Yeah.
But yeah, it'll be like in Helvetica and be like, out. The font, that's one thing. It has to be in Courier. And what's funny is our professor of Fed, he's like, there's this Courier new font, don't use that.
Oh,
has
really?
To be Courier, yeah.
I did not only remember that.
Right, which I didn't know before that class, but yeah, like that's like the screenplay format. And it's also the same font that typewriters used.
Interesting. Yeah.
So okay. I think it's mainly a tradition thing. Hollywood's loves traditions, including another tidbit we learned was that they don't have the number one on the first page of screenplays.
Yep.
They start numbering on page two for some reason. And the format or the screenwriting software does that today.
Yep, still does it.
It's useful, I think, in these programs, how they keep track of your locations and your characters. So it's easy that when you are when you begin typing, there's an autocomplete and it just kind of keeps your flow going, and it will keep all of the particular like exterior outside or like exterior church or exterior whatever, and then it keeps all the lingo or all the jargon there.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
It'll help you with spacing. Like if you hit enter twice, it assumes you want to do a new scene, so it'll prompt you interior or exterior like right away. So we talked about Movie Magic, but there's also newer ones like Ben, you used Keltex for a while, didn't you?
Keltex was free, which was great.
Right. So that's a more intro
one. But it still kind of stands up to these other ones too as far as formatting goes. I mean, it ultimately kind of comes down to personal preference for like the small little things, and then what is widely used, because we talked about Movie Magic being an industry standard, but there's also Final Draft as well, which is also an industry standard.
So but Keltex, that's also available on iPad and iOS, right?
Correct.
I remember that being a big selling point, because Movie Magic obviously isn't, and it's kind of a cool idea to be able to, well, this was back in like 2012 or something, to be able to share those files over like Dropbox or something.
Final Draft is now just getting that. I think they they recently released an iOS application, but they're going to update soon too. So
I've been using Movie Magic for so long, and now I think I'm finally starting to move over, just because it's not really supported anymore. But Final Draft, I guess, how does that, does it separate itself like from the others, or is it pretty similar?
I'd say it's pretty similar.
Yeah,
it's like updated still, so that's nice. Like if I was gonna go out and buy one, I'd buy Final Draft.
And I think Ben, you said that was on sale.
It was on sale from when I bought it, and then it had like a free upgrade when we get to the next option, which is cool.
Okay, yeah, kind of like, I mean, is it available in the App Store, the Mac App Store?
Yes, but I think in order to get the discount, you have to go through their website.
I know that's the one that everyone talks about as being the industry standard for. Excuse me, for a while. But I guess besides like pressing enter and going to a new scene, it also has a cool feature where, you know, you hit tab and it prompts you for a character, piece of dialogue. Mm-hmm. If it's like a character you've already had speak, then it'll automatically like prompt you to, you know,
it has
enter
like
their name.
It has a little bit more shortcuts than like Celtics would.
Right, right. Or like if it's VO or OS, you know, after their name, it'd prompt you for that too. Mm-hmm. A lot of cool little things like that. Also, it'll put continued.
Yeah, you know, I like that.
If it's like someone's talking, you enter, you know, a line or two of exposition and they speak again, it'll automatically put that in. Mm-hmm. And these are really important features if you want to stay within the format. But unfortunately, a lot of these pieces of software don't correct for things like, we begin by examining through a window and the camera slowly pans up, and it's like, the reason I bring that up is because also one of the first things Kellen and I learned was that you don't typically put in camera direction in screenplay.
And you can't start a scene with a pronoun.
Like what?
Like we.
Oh, right.
And you can't use we because you're... Yeah.
But the thing that keeps me from doing that is I just... Every time I read or find myself wanting to write that, I just say it in a really pretentious voice, like... We begin our scene. Just like a douchebag kind of style.
It makes it okay then, right?
Yeah, it does. because it was almost like hammered into us, these rules.
Mm-hmm. I think there's, well, one piece of software that we're missing that we didn't mention was Writer Duet. So Writer Duet's free. It's online. You can use that. And then you can also get, you can upgrade to like a professional version, and you get many other tools to help with structure.
That was the one that, that was the one we used for the 48-hour film festival, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so you, Kellen, and then our other writer, Cable, after we got the story pretty much locked in where we wanted, the rest of us worked out like actor schedules and like equipment and locations, while you two guys went into the other room and just wrote using this software. And I'm assuming it was beneficial to have you both writing the script at the same time.
Yeah, it's super nice because if you're doing it at the same time, then you can see what each other, what they're doing. And then you can also... you can go back and go over what the other person just wrote, like, I'll just kind of fine tune this and make it a little better.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. That was the first time I'd seen that software. And then, is it just two people that can use it?
No, you can, I don't know what the max is, but I've had up to, I think, four people on it.
So it should be writer, duet, or trio, or quartet.
Yes.
That's cool, nice. Though. And so it's kind of like, obviously you can do that in Google Docs, but that's not in format necessarily until Google comes out with like a screenwriting doc piece of software. But it's free, you said, so that's cool.
Yep, it's free.
And I'm assuming it has a lot of those shortcuts too?
Yeah, it has every
shortcut.
Oh, so
it's like...
It's basically like Celta or Celtics, whatever.
Yeah. Celtics, yeah.
And then I haven't used Celtics very much, like at all, but I think I used it once. I'm like, ugh, I don't like this.
It feels a little bloated. I mean, the thing about Celtics is that they provide other apps too that all sync with your script. So there's like a storyboarding thing. There is a, when you're on set, your production notes, and it all kind of goes back to your script. So when you're making these other things, whatever you have in your script will also translate over to this other thing. But it's like creating an ecosystem, an environment for you to use for your production.
That's cool. So it sounds like basically all these softwares, they do the same thing. It's just a look and feel preference, right?
I think there's a good portion of it.
Yeah, because I mean, it sounds like they all do a good job of putting your content in the right format. But it's just a matter of like what your workflow is. Like Final Draft, I mean, that's still an expensive piece of software. So I guess I'm just kind of wondering, what incentive does anyone have starting up to to work up to that. It's like, you know, if you're making movies and you have free Windows Movie Maker or iMovie, you're like, one day I'll get Premiere or Final Cut and work up to that. It costs money. Like, what's the version? Like, why would someone starting with Kel-Tex or Writer Duet want to work up to Final Draft? I don't know. To sound cool.
Probably,
to just like go to Starbucks and be like, oh, I'm just going to boost up. Final Draft here.
Just working on my script, sip my latte.
Oh, I finally made it. I'm working on Final Draft.
Right? Yeah, unfortunately, all these programs won't actually help you sit down and write. You have to be the person to actually sit down. Maybe. And they just make it easier. They're just tools.
Maybe that's it. Maybe they're trying to present people with the illusion of, like, if you only bought this piece of software, we will draw that creative inspiration out of you. It'll be so easy. It's like infomercials for like the Bowflex or the Total Gym or something. Like, listen, you haven't worked out up until now, but this will make it all worth it.
This is gonna help
all of your problems.
This is gonna I mean, as we all know, like, the blank page can be really daunting, and maybe just it's good to get a piece of software that's a good tool to help you with format, but nothing's going to give you the ideas for you.
Nope.
Aside from the writing software, I've tried, over the years, I've tried a couple of pieces of software. Like, I was telling you guys earlier about this app called Storyometer, and it's this cool little steampunk styled app that basically tries to do the same thing. It tries to, like, okay, you put in a character, and the app is like, okay, what does this character do? Like, who do they want this thing from? And it tries to, like, prompt you down this path of some sort of plot. But I struggle with that too, because I don't know, when you guys write stories, like, do you need that structure, or is it more organic? Is it like, how does it typically come out of you guys?
I think for me, I want it to be more structured. I want to, like, because it feels better. It feels like I've done the work, and it's like, oh, this is going to fit here, this is going to fit there, this is going to sync up. But what I often find is that when I try to do that, I end up not writing a lot, because I get stuck in, like, oh, this needs to be perfect in this way or not. Where for me, I find that it's just better if I just write and then go back and find all the shit I wrote and then work from there.
Yeah, I think you can do it either way. I've done it in the past where I've come up with, like, the structure and then the scene breakdown, and then at some point, like, I was 3/4 of the way through and I was like, ah, fuck, I'm just gonna write, and then I just went and did it, but everything was kind of in its place at that moment.
Yeah,
and I find it is easier to write stuff if you already have a structure and stuff like that.
Sure.
Set, you know, like, what does a character want? And then, because you're way more prepared, it's kind of like storyboarding before you go into a shoot. You're like, I know what I want, and I'll get that, or I can just change it, or I can also come up with other random stuff.
That's an interesting technique. So it's like, you most, you come up with the structure and all the plot points, and then you kind of just set that aside, and then as you write, it naturally falls into place. That's interesting.
Yeah, most of the time it does. You're like, because you're like, oh yeah, that would go really well right here, and that fits with the structure.
Cool. Well, yeah, so those are some good pieces of software if you're just starting off, Kel-Tex or Writer Duet, and if you want to work your way up to more expensive stuff, there's Movie Magic or Final Draft. Coming up, we're going to talk about our tricks of the trade with screenplay format. Stay with us. All right, so we're looking at other ways to improve your writing. This week, or this month, this episode, we're talking about the formatting of screenplay. The most common, and the one that I'm most familiar with, is the three-act structure. Again, going back to our time in film school, that was the one that was instilled in us. And that's basically like, you know, your hero starts out and you have the break of the routine early on, and then you have plot point one, which is the end of the first act. And the nearest example I can think of is like Pirates of the Caribbean 1. And that one, the break of the routine is Captain Jack Sparrow arriving to the harbor.
I love that scene.
And then, like, the Black Pearl and all that stuff, that's the break of the routine. And then plot point one is when Will frees Jack, and then they go off on their journey together. So that, like, sets the plot in motion. And then you have your midpoint, and then plot point two, which is like the end of act two, and that's where, like, the hero's at, like, the lowest moment, and then the climax and the end. It's like your film's divided into thirds, Do you guys do that at all, or what's mm-hmm. what's your process, Kellen?
I tend to think, okay, how many pages do I want this to be roughly? And then mm-hmm. I divide that by four. And then I have four different sections to write because, mm-hmm. like, act two is going to be just double of yeah, what your yeah. first act and your third act is. And then, yeah, just try and figure out where those points are going to be and where I have to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you ever find, like, it's limiting, though, to determine a page count in advance and then try and meet those?
Not really. I mean, I started doing this about, like, a year ago, and I don't think so. I think it's good to have a target mm-hmm. in mind, so you're, like, because you might end up shooting it yourself. And yeah. you want to know how many pages you have. Like, if it's an 80-page script, you're like, that's doable. That's going to be a low-budget thing. But, yeah, I think it frees up more creativity, honestly.
Okay, cool. Ben, what's your typical process?
I think I start with what I want the story to accomplish, what the intent is. And typically what I do is I kind of write a statement of intent. So whatever I want to write or whatever I end up creating always goes back to this key theme of what I'm trying to share or whatever I'm trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And typically that ends up being kind of like a hero's journey kind of thing where you have a person who has their normal life and this lie that they believe, and then they're thrust into the situation where they have to learn more, grow as a character, and then reach kind of like a new normal. But all of what happens in that, all of the events and dialogue, I want to somehow relate back to what I'm trying to tell, what I'm trying to accomplish.
But from like a structural standpoint, you were telling me earlier it's kind of like a
valley kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, so how does that work?
So if you think of a valley, you are starting off like at, let's see, your normal level, and then some sort of event happens that kind of brings your character further and further down this hill, down this valley. And then when you start getting to the bottom, as you said, the lowest point, you start kind of bringing that back up into a new normal. So it's kind of like they're going down and then they're progressing back up. So you feel like you have gone somewhere and you've achieved some sort of victory almost. You've
yeah,
done something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And you know, we've seen this structure so many times throughout Hollywood and Western films. And I've seen a few video essays that try to, you know, explain that this is like the only story format, which of course it isn't, but it's the one we're the most familiar with. And mm-hmm. we've seen it again and again through like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and, you know, some of the best known movies. I mean, are there any examples of films that don't necessarily fall in that structure that still work? It's hard to think of them.
Pulp Fiction immediately comes to mind.
Yeah, which, you know what, that would almost be like a kind of a day-long challenge to try and piece together how that might fit in that format. But yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a very non-linear way of telling a story.
There's one movie supposedly that is like that. It's called Slacker. It's Richard Linklater. And basically nothing happens. I guess it's very boring.
Yeah.
And there's not any events like that.
Is that frustrating? I'm assuming that you've seen this movie.
I have not seen it. No.
Oh, okay.
But I've heard for the person that did watch it was very frustrating.
Well, yeah. Actually, yeah. I mean, if you go back and look at maybe like French New Wave films or just like films outside the U.S. that are from a few decades ago before, you know, this format was as widespread, I think you'll see that. I'm reminded of in film history, we watched some of Ingrid Bergman's films that, you know, you'll find entire scenes of people just
hanging out.
Yeah, hanging out. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm just thinking like, this doesn't serve much purpose to the script, does it? But, it, you know, it adds to the piece as a whole if we're looking at it from like maybe an artistic or poetic way. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like picturing other screenwriters like, what is this drivel?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think one of the jobs of a screenwriter and perhaps a director or producer is to, yeah, look at the story as a whole, the script as a whole, and trying to trim the fat and just get down to like cut to the chase is
sure,
part of where that term came from. I mean, do you guys think that, I mean, this format's obviously a powerful tool, but, you know, maybe there's an argument to be made that we've lost some of the artistry along the way, some of the more contemplative moments of films from like, yeah, some of the earlier days, like Bergman, where there are scenes that may not serve a purpose but kind of maybe add to the atmosphere or something.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's the job of the screenwriter or the job of the director? Or maybe it's just a team effort. But
yeah, maybe it is. Because like I have a hard time seeing that in the script. Like, this dude goes to this room and there's just a bunch of kids dancing around. We sit there for 10 minutes.
Yeah. For 10 minutes, great scene. Love
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you get a script and then I wonder, like, as a director, what can I do with this? What can I, how can I bring this to the screen? I see all of what you're like you're trying to accomplish through, like, through dialogue, but then I need to think of other elements that are kind of help aid the dialogue, like what's going to happen in this specific space? How does it relate, like, how all of the colors, everything like that can relate back to whatever you're trying to accomplish?
I think formatting isn't everything. I mean, there's one film I remember, Percy Jackson and the
Olympians.
Yeah, the whatever.
The
that
Lightning
was.
Thief.
Yeah,
the Lightning that's what it
yeah,
was.
Yeah, that was the first one because there was two, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume there would be.
I saw the first one and Hollywood hated loves
its sequels.
I hated every minute of it, but it followed the format. You know what I mean? Like,
was it very predictable?
It was structurally sound. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, one of the downsides of this format is you'll run into scripts that feel like, okay, we're on page 60 now. Here comes a turn. Or this is page 90. This is the low point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you, like, Kellen, like, what do you try to avoid that? Or like, what?
Sometimes. Well, I mean, I obviously try to avoid it. So it's not predictable, but it's got to be something that's like, that's new and unpredictable. That's going to propel the story forward. You know, like an example, like romantic comedies. They have that low point. It's like, oh, Jesus. Yeah, they broke up, and now they're just hanging out.
Yep.
And they're separate, and they're sad. It's so predictable, and like they're going to get back together.
Mm-hmm. I think the film to me that is most guilty of that, or maybe not the most, but that I just rolled my eyes so hard was Wedding Crashers.
Mm.
Where
Where
it's like, it's the old cliche where, you know, the guy and girl fall for each other, but under false pretenses. Like, she thinks the guy's actually X when he's not.
But it was a new concept. Like, it was super successful, which is very strange.
It was a hilarious comedy because it had, like, that... It was the buddy comedy thing with Owen Wilson and the other dude.
Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, Vince Vaughn. Mm.
Luke Wilson.
But yeah, so then when you know, the romantic female lead, like, figured out that he wasn't who he said he was, then she's like, I never want to see you again. And then... At the climax of the movie, he busts in to Vince Vaughn's wedding. And he's like, listen, I realized that you're the only one who can make my heart beat slower and faster at the same time. Or some bullshit like that. And she's just like, she turns to her fiance and is like, I can't marry you. What? Oh, God. This guy? Yeah. And yet, like, it's still like a movie people like. But I think the format sometimes just works to the detriment of... Of romantic comedies, for sure, and for like sure every year we see like Christmas movies too.
I think it's good to. I think the good movies end up being the ones that hide it the best.
Hide it the best, or maybe even subvert it.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a movie that's done that recently.
Subverted it, or
the structure,
hidden the structure.
Both. That's just something entirely new.
I mean, I think about like The Departed. I mean, that's like almost 10 years old now, but that was a film that to me at least didn't feel like it followed a structure.
It was
because each scene almost like had such a presence on its own that it was like that other metaphor where it felt like a series of dominoes, like one scene led to another. I think that's a good way to hide format, is like have each scene lead directly into the next, like this happened and so because of that this happened immediately after.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you get stuck in format, you're like, okay, here's the plot points I have to hit. So in the middle, it can be a little filler. And that's kind of like a tent pole analogy where you have the filler scenes that don't really add up to much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Well, every scene... Sometimes I look at scenes like they're a sequence or they're a movie in themselves. And then putting those together... You get a sequence,
yeah.
So you can like divide the page number by 8 or 12 sequences or whatever, and see how that builds together to avoid having those scenes just be filler. There is, like we said, we were speaking about earlier, a cut to the chase.
Yeah.
Make sure every scene has a piece of information in it, whether that's character or story or motivation. Mm-hmm. Like, just make sure that we're giving the audience something, and it's not pointless. And that goes against what we were saying for the like Bergman stuff.
Yeah, and like, or have, you know, you have the characters in the scene and you know in advance what each character wants in that scene and like who they want it from and what they're trying to get out of. There was an analogy that we were taught in screenwriting class that I found myself more disagreeing with, and that was you have your beginning point and you have your end point, and your end point that you already know is the lighthouse, and like, and that's what's guiding you through the mist of the screenplay. But if you already know the end necessarily, like, I find myself just kind of like piecing things together because, oh man, it's got to end this way, so I got to make things fit.
Okay.
As opposed to just kind of like uncovering it almost. I don't know. I guess it depends on...
I think it totally depends on the writer. Because I think Tarantino does that. Like, he'll just...
Oh, he knows how it's going to end?
No. He doesn't. He's just like, here's the characters. I kind of want to just see what happens. Yeah. And that's really cool when that does happen.
Sure.
Because it's very unpredictable.
Yeah. Organic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think his last few films, especially Inglourious Basterds and Django, you'll see that where just like... scenes will just take a completely unexpected turn.
Yeah, which is super great.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. he's a master at building tension for 10, 15 minutes and mm-hmm. then just like having it blow up.
And then mm-hmm. a body actually blows up.
Right. yeah, my favorite, I mean, Inglourious, there's so many tense scenes. Like, the opening scene's incredibly tense.
Mm-hmm.
The scene where Shoshana goes with the one sniper to lunch, and then Hans Lander sits down and they talk. That scene's mm-hmm. so tense. Mm-hmm. The scene where in the bar, oh man, when they're...
That's a great scene.
Yeah,
yeah.
So many good scenes. And that's the thing that I feel like is really missing from a lot of movies, like good scenes where people are even just sitting at a table talking.
Mm-hmm.
But they have like, in that scene, their objective was, we got to get out of this bar. But and then the one I forget her name, the female spy was like, okay, no, let's just have one drink
mm-hmm.
and then we'll mm-hmm. go. But he's Tarantino's a master of like just having that carrot, like, okay, we're almost there, just after this drink then thinking it out, oh wait, no this happened, the mm-hmm. SS officer heard mm-hmm. the accent, now it's shifted.
It's kind of like you have your regular dialogue. It's everything sounds fine, but there's actually like subtext that's going on too. And I mm-hmm. love specifically in that scene where they're talking and looking at each other, looking and seeming like it's a good time. But then the camera goes below the table and you see both of them have their pistol drawn mm-hmm. at each other's like crotch. And it's just like, oh shit, something's going to go down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's awesome. Subtext, that's another good one. We had a subtext exercise, writing exercise, and I did abysmal because what I thought I was being subtextual with, I was actually being completely on the nose and explicit with. Because
mm-hmm.
like, so, I don't know, sometimes I'm thinking like, they'll never understand what this means. I have to be clear.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like that's a tricky thing when you're writing. Like, how much are you going to explain? How much are you going to give away?
Mm-hmm.
How much are you going to leave unexplained? That's a really tricky thing too, and I think it just has to... It's like experimentation. You just have to kind of feel it out.
Yep.
There's no right or wrong way to do it.
There's a writer, Walter Hill. He wrote, I think co-wrote part of the first Alien movie.
Mm.
And he's written a bunch of other stuff. If you read his scripts, there's very little text. And you hear the dialogue. You like read the dialogue, and it's so small. It's just like clips. But you understand exactly what's going on. Like, they all connect the dots. And normally... you start out with a lot of dialogue. You're like, okay, I have to cut something because this is so much stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, the less is usually better.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you bring up cutting, I remember our film Dawn Under Heaven. When I was trying to finish the script for that, I think it was at like 34 pages, and I was like, I gotta get down to 30. That's my goal. And I found myself cutting. Like, I went through every single line, and I'm cutting every word I possibly can, and I'm like replacing some words that could be written shorter by a letter. Mm. And I finally got it down to 30, even though all the while I'm like, oh, I really don't want to cut that, I really don't want to cut this. And then I did, and I'm just like, oh, I actually don't miss those things that I cut.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it goes back to the joke that they had sitting in the film department in Augsburg. How many screenwriters does it take to change a light bulb? The light bulb's in and it's staying in.
Oh, nice.
It's like they hold on to their babies. cool. Well, yeah, that's some of the formatting things that we take into account when writing. Hopefully it was informative. When we come back, we'll be talking about Kubo and the Two Strings. We'll be back. So, guys, Kubo and the Two Strings. This is an animated film. Like, real-life animated, stop motion. It has, like, a weird, almost, like, low frame rate look to it, if that makes sense.
Sure.
like Nightmare Before Christmas mm-hmm. had like that low frame rate mm-hmm. look. So, mm-hmm. man, it's amazing to look at the behind the scenes where they'll show like the one ship, the mm-hmm. rig they had, and like frame by frame how they have the characters flying on these giant robotic arms.
Jeez.
It's incredible.
It's literally like these stop motion characters are actually just actors in front of a green
right,
screen.
Right.
And they're just, that's the way you're doing
it. And they did use green screen for part of it. Kellen, so you, Kellen, you haven't had the chance to see it yet, but what do you know? Do you know anything about it?
I would say that's basically all I know.
Is it a stop motion?
That it's a stop motion film. And is it Tim Burton or Guillermo del Toro?
I just know the director, Travis Knight.
Travis Knight, okay.
Yeah, we saw it a few weeks ago at the Lagoon here in Minneapolis, and I thought it was incredible. It did a lot of things right, and it did follow format mm-hmm. really well. And there were a few things from a storytelling perspective that I took note of that I told Ben of right away. One of them being that it set up Kubo's, he's the protagonist, he's this boy. It set up his routine really well before it broke the routine. So we saw what a day in the life of Kubo was. You know, he wakes up, he has to take care of his mom, who's basically like a,
hurt something. She's kind of has some sort of amnesia about her or whatever.
But she like she doesn't move. She sits and he has to feed her, and she mm-hmm. just stares off into the distance.
Yeah,
he goes into town to play music and earn money, and he always has to be back in the cave that he lives in with his mom. He has to be back by sunset. He can't stay out past dark. He doesn't know why. That's just what his mom tells him. And then when the sun goes down, then she kind of wakes up, and then they talk for a bit. It's a little strange, but it gives you little breadcrumbs of like...
It gives you an idea of what normal life is for Kubo, mm-hmm. and then his own mystery in it. Like, he doesn't entirely know why he has to be back by midnight or whatever.
They set up a really good little bit of mystery, though, when he... is very curious about his father. He doesn't know anything about him.
Yeah.
But he knows that he's dead, I think. And all it's this like ceremony that the other townsfolk are doing where they light candles and speak to the ghosts of relatives past.
Yeah, spirits, whatever.
So he goes and lights a lantern, or tries to light a lantern, but it won't light. And that's the way that they know that the spirit's talking with them. And finally, he's there so long, the sun goes down. And bam, things get interesting.
Yeah. I think it's interesting how even before they have the routine, they set you up with the opening. Oh, there's a little bit of mystery of like how his mother brings him to this island.
A prologue.
Almost. Yeah, a prologue. And they have this this thing that Kubo starts saying. It's like, pay attention to everything. If you blink, you will miss something. And like you won't...
Our hero might be in peril or something like that.
Sure. Yeah. So it draws you in, and then you're given this little bit of that's confusing, obviously climatic, and then you go back to this normal, but this whole normal has the undertones of, I mean, it must relate to what they showed you, right? Yeah. So there's all the anticipation that's kind of building there.
The film does a lot of plants, right? So it'll plant something that doesn't make sense on its own, but it will pay off further on down the road.
Mm-hmm.
It also does, so when Kubo sets off on his journey in the film, he's joined by a couple of companions. And what I thought it did brilliantly from a metaphorical perspective is the companions were essentially parts of his psyche, right?
Sure.
So we had this guardian. When he was with his mom, he had this little monkey totem.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was gone and he wasn't with his mother anymore, it actually became a magical, like it was a monkey that was like protecting him.
Mm-hmm.
So I was imagining him going on this journey by himself, and like that monkey that was protecting him was like, just the part of him that's left over from his mom, like a Life of Pi style.
Sure.
And it made me think of how a lot of times in writing or a lot of times in storytelling, the people that are around the hero, around the protagonist, a lot of times represent parts of that hero's psyche, a lot of parts of their personality.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing that came across to me really well. But it also did humor really well. It balanced the humor with like the dark moments, mm-hmm. and I think animated films do that a lot.
I think that the animated movies that we see through Hollywood do a very good job of entertaining two different audiences. specifically the children that are watching that the parents are probably bringing to see this, and then also the parents themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think the darker undertones, while maybe not necessarily a child might not understand it besides just being like a little nervous or scared, a parent can maybe relate to it a little bit more, so it kind of engages them as well. Because like, I remember like going to see the Pokemon movie with my dad, and he fell asleep. but seeing like Toy Story or something like that, everybody's engaged.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Pokemon movie. Like, Kellen, have you seen that?
No, I have not. Was that like 2000?
It was, yeah, around 2000.
No, there's one before 2000, because there was a Pokemon 2000.
Oh my god.
Pokemon, the first movie, like Mewtwo Strikes Back.
That's
what it was.
This is so cool.
That doesn't do a good job of catering to both audiences. Like, mm-hmm. I think even as a kid I saw it and I thought, okay, this is reaching. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Films that do both really well. I mean, it's challenging, but mm-hmm. it can be done. I remember this is the one I quote all the time. Toy Story has the moment where Buzz is first arrives and he's showing off, and Woody's super jealous. And he's showing off the laser, and Woody's like, "What? It's just a little stupid light bulb that blinks." And Mr. Potato Head's like, "Oh, laser envy."
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. I don't know if I get that.
Yeah. just going back to the format of Kubo. So we have our brilliant routine that's set up and then broken, but done in a way where, like, it sets up the routine and then it sets up the stakes, right? So you have Kubo doing his daily routine, and then his mom explains like, listen, you were almost out past dark. Like, you absolutely cannot do that. And he's like, I know, da da da. And kids naturally want to be mischievous and break the rules. And then she sets up the stakes of like, during the day when he's singing his song, he's talking about this epic battle between the Moon King and what's the name of the hero? I forget too. Just the samurai warrior, basically. Yeah. And he never gets to the end of the story because of this. The sun starts to set by the time he gets to the end, and no one knows how the story ends.
It's
really cool. Eventually, when he is out past dark, he's immediately pursued by these two witches. I don't know, what are
they? They're supposed to be his aunts.
Yeah, but but they're like these weird witch-like figures.
Yeah, I think the what they're supposed to be is some sort of divine beings. They're supposed to be of the sky. Because his grandfather is the Moon King, his mother. And
well, actually, we don't really. I mean, we get that hinted at, but it's not till a little further along where it
further on. Yeah.
A lot of times when, especially animated films do this, where there's like a threat, quote unquote, that the hero has to like run away mm-hmm. from. A lot of times it doesn't really feel threatening.
Sure.
Like they're just, oh yeah, this is the story. Or like Percy Jackson, that's a good example where it's like, yeah, sure, you're in danger, whatever. You have screenwriting armor. But
armor.
I actually I think they did the threat really well in this one where like Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship, for example, where the Ringwraiths are chasing Frodo. Like I felt like, yeah, like that was actually, they were actually after him. When the two witches were going after Kubo, like they were just trying to like kill him, rip his other eye out, because he only has one eye and they mm-hmm. want his other eye.
Yeah.
It and the way they were fighting with the guardian monkey, like it felt like visceral and genuine.
And there's a little bit of a foreboding too, because they off his mom like right away. Like you think his mom's going to be an important part of the story.
Oh, yeah.
And the aunts kill her, or she sacrifices herself. Mm-hmm. And so we think like, oh wow, this important person gone. Yeah. And then he's just by himself with this monkey, and they are told of this story of the armor of the hero.
Yeah, the legendary three pieces of armor.
Yeah, the sword, the breastplate, and then the helmet. Mm-hmm. And this kind of sets you up as an audience member saying like, okay, these three things need to happen. And these are three specific points of this is how the story is going to progress. He gets the sword. All right, now he has to get the chest plate. Great, now he has to get the helmet.
Yeah. And he's eventually confronted by the Moon King, his grandfather, and the Moon King killed cursed his father mm-hmm. because his father took away the Moon King's eldest daughter,
mm-hmm.
Kubo's mom, from this divine figure. Mm-hmm. And they had this confrontation near the end where he basically is like, you don't understand, this world is pain and it's suffering, and I just want you to be happy and perfect and divine.
Mm-hmm.
And Kubo rejects that, like a lot of hero motifs do. Like Hercules is another one where they reject their divinity in a sacrificial way. But what I liked, Kubo gets the three pieces of armor and tries to battle the Moon King, but he can't do it. Like, he can't overpower him, so he throws off the armor, and instead, oh, we kind of forgot this, but as he lost his mom, and then figured out that this other figure who was with him was his dad, and he got these, as he lost these people, he took bits of their hair and made them into bracelets.
Or from his father, it's the bowstring.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The bowstring. And so as he casts off the armor, he takes the string and the hair, and he fashions them into strings for his instrument. And then he uses that. He has this kind of magical ability when he plays his instrument to, like, manipulate matter.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses that to, like, conjure up spirits of people left behind, and kind of overpowers the Moon King. It's a really cool confrontation.
It's a nice finishing moment, yeah. Specifically because you have with the title of the movie, The Two Strings, it's Kobu and his two parents.
And I was like, man, I really hope they bring that back to why that's the title, because I'm so confused.
Well, it's a three-string instrument too. So it's the two strings from him, or from his parents, and then he pulls out his own piece of hair and ties it. So it's all of it together. So
that's really cool.
Yeah.
But and anyway, so I bring that all up because that's a good example of, it follows format, I think, to a T. But in a way that doesn't necessarily feel cliche, because it's it takes unexpected turns, right? I mean, he doesn't get the armor and then defeat the enemy. Like, he has to make certain sacrifices and grow in certain ways. He has to learn to, you know, remember and honor his parents, but also leave them behind.
Yeah.
And I think that's great. I love to see more stories like that.
I think it did a good job of hiding things from the beginning, but I think as they revealed more, I kind of saw through the facade a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like when they reveal that the monkey is actually, or when the monkey says that to Kubo, "I'm your mother." Like that's like that, and then the beetle comes in and they kind of have like a little bit of like flirting romance between each other, and it's like, okay, he's probably the father.
I didn't really need that. I think that was a little too much.
Sure.
That was the only thing that bugged me a little bit. I think we could have done without that. I think we saw that.
Yeah.
Metaphorically. We didn't need it to come out and say like, yes, these are these people.
Yeah.
Hmm. But anyway, so yeah, Kellen, you kind of want to see it now, don't you?
Yeah, it sounds very original.
You didn't spoil it.
No, it sounds cool, and I think that's why if it did follow the structure and why it succeeded and you weren't bored by it, is that it was just purely original.
Yeah.
Plus, it was very visually cool to watch.
I mean, and honestly, I noticed this right away because it was stop motion and it was just photography of physical pieces in front of us. It just had a level of realism that it's hard to match in CG.
One thing that you brought up, the to increase the stakes, where the mom is just killed, like that's as a bummer as that is in the movie, like that's a great way to push him out of that adventure because he has to find out something about himself,
like in Star Wars, Aunt Beru,
or
Uncle Owen, Luke,
or like the Lion King, you know, he loses his dad and just like your world is just messed up.
It's an event of trauma that thrusts them out of their normal,
right?
Out of what is safe,
right?
Because at which point did she die?
It's plot point one, basically.
When he stays out too late,
the first frame,
or
she's just
routine,
dead.
Or one of those,
yeah.
I forget which point. Like basically, 15 minutes in or so.
Oh, something okay.
Like that.
So that's probably the break of the routine.
Yeah.
How long was the movie?
It was feature. I'd have to sit down and try and break down the plot points, but it was right around there. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I highly recommend it. So, Kellen, any upcoming projects? Anything you want to plug?
Oh man. Yeah, I want to plug. I'll plug 10 Second Mysteries.
Yeah. So what is that?
So 10 Second Mysteries follows a French detective named Gaston Saint Pierre, and his bumbling sidekick named Pumpy. That's P-U-M-P-Y, not Peppy,
right?
As some people have mistaken it for. But they're obviously, we try to make them 10 seconds, but sometimes they're going to go over, and sometimes they go way over because we think that's funny.
Right.
But the first one's going to drop this Thursday, the 8th, on our Facebook page.
Can you have a little tease for us?
Yeah, the first one involves we reference a movie, a 1990, I think it's 1991 or 1990, Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
So yeah, get ready for that.
Okay. Can you give us a little Now the Mystery Is?
Oh God, I did this on the other podcast. Fucking A. Let's see. This is the tease for the first one. Now the mystery is, who stole all the pearls? So there it is.
That's great. Love it. Well, we can't wait to see that. Well, thanks for joining us, Colin, on this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. And thank you for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We will see you next time.